E-commerce Gold is brought to you by Rewind. Accidents happen. Maybe you installed an app and it messed up your theme, or a store collaborator deleted product images by mistake. It's a common myth that Shopify has a backup that you can use when something goes wrong with your store. The fact is they don't. That's untrue. That myth is busted. So what do? You use Rewind to equip your Shopify store with automated backups. Rewind should be the first app you install to protect your store against human error, misbehaving apps, or collaborators gone bad. It's like having your very own magic undo button. It's trusted by over 100,000 businesses, from side hustles to the biggest online retailers like Nix, Lord & Taylor, and Moomin. It's even a Shopify Plus certified app. Best of all, visit rewind.com/ecommercegold and get your first month for absolutely nothing, free, on us. The Ecom Gold podcast has partnered with Clearco to provide you with financial tools to grow your business without having to give away equity. Clearco is the world's largest e-commerce investor and growth platform, giving founders the financial tools, capital, and network they need to grow. Plug in your Shopify store and your loan could be agreed within just 24 hours. Visit clear.co/partner/vixxr, V-I-X-X-R, for exclusive deals, £1,000 off your first loan as a podcast listener, and more information. This show is brought to you in collaboration with vixxr, a leading Shopify agency with a mission to grow and migrate brands to Shopify Plus. They've worked with some of the world's largest brands and can help you level up your e-commerce performance. Visit vixxr.com, V-I-X-X-R.com, for more information. Sean, thank you for joining us on the Ecom Gold podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm really good. And me and Sean, we've spoken once or twice before. Sean was one of my first followers on Twitter. Just so happened to pop up in my feed. And has been a great follow since day one, really. I really appreciate the content that you put out there and your dedication to e-commerce. So can you give us a bit of an overview of who you are and your professional career and what got you to where you are today?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Sean McGinnis. I'm the president and integrator at Kuru Footwear. Career journey has been a long and strange one. I have an undergrad degree in acting and a law degree. I spent 10 or 15 years in direct sales, selling legal research materials to lawyers originally, and then eventually marketing services to lawyers. So I was part of a large business that built websites and marketed to small law firms across the United States. That kind of exposed me to the notion of marketing, and I became a bit of an internal expert regarding search engine optimization. And in the mid-2000s, the company tapped me on the shoulder and invited me to come into a corporate role from sales management and to lead the SEO team. So that was my kind of first marketing, air quote, function or job responsibility. So sort of came in over the top rather than coming in through traditional means of kind of working your way up through a marketing org. Took a couple other roles along the way, eventually found my way into a business inside of Sears in Chicago, leading the marketing function for an e-com division that did 9 figures online and 8 figures in profit. And while the rest of Sears was not doing so great, it was a lot of fun and learned a ton and really fell in love with e-commerce during that role. Relocated out here, was recruited to lead a big digital, kind of a hybrid agency in Salt Lake City. So I've been in Salt Lake City now for about 7 years and joined Kuru almost 3 years ago. So time is flying. That's for sure.
Sounds like it. Sounds like you've had a really good, varied career there, and one that no one probably could have predicted when you went to acting school, was it?
Yeah. Undergrad was a degree in acting, did some musical theater along the way, some drama, not so big in the comedy, but have a face made for radio. So I found my way into marketing instead.
And have you kept that up at all? Is that anything that you still engage with, the acting side of things?
It is not. No, I it's funny. I back in the day, I've said this a number of times, that acting, selling, and lawyering are kind of three sides of the same coin, right? If you're planning to be on stage or you're planning to be in front of a courtroom or a jury, or in front of a prospective customer, right? You're trying to convince them of something eventually. And so it's the notion of influence, choosing your words carefully, displaying an image, that type of thing that all kind of rolls up into those three different varied career paths. So
Yeah. I completely agree. I can't remember who said exactly, but someone said that every interaction is a sale, which I guess in is one way of looking at it, and it's kind of true. So tell us a bit more about Kuru, where you are today. How big's the business? What kind of team size are you operating with? What channels are you operating in? And what are the products that you sell?
Yeah, so Kuru is a specialized footwear company. We invented some technology, our CEO and founder did, back in 2008. The original thesis was, how do I make a shoe that performs better, frankly? You know, there is a whole rash of folks out there that buy these expensive running shoes, and to make them work for you, air quote, many other folks turn around and purchase an aftermarket shoe insert. So his general thesis was, why do you have to do that? Wouldn't it be better if I could engineer a way to take those materials and shapes and build them directly into every pair of shoes? It's got to be cheaper. It's got to work better. And he invented this technology that we call the Kuru sole. There's more than just that in invention, but that's the primary driver of our success, is the Kuru sole. And that's built into every pair of shoes that we make, whether they be sneakers or sandals or hiking boots. It just so happens that technology helps people with pretty bad foot pain resolve those issues, especially plantar fasciitis and things around the heel, because that's where the technology lives. And so we've been at it since 2008. The business launched originally back then as a more traditional retail-oriented brand. But in the middle of the great financial crisis, the business was forced to kind of pivot as retailers were pulling their orders. And so our CEO and founder, again, went off and wrote his very first website in Drupal Commerce to try to sell these shoes to consumers. And along the way, again, stumbled into the fact that these things really help people with foot pain. I was hearing directly from customers like, these are amazing. You know, they didn't really buy them for that purpose originally. And so we've leaned into that over time. Naturally, it's been 13, 14 years now, and the business has grown. In terms of your question about size, we don't speak to financial specifics because we're private, but I can say that we've grown really rapidly the last couple of years, and that we are profitable every year except one, I think, in the company history. So today we're fully bootstrapped. There were some early kind of friends and family type investors that are no longer with us along the way. And so the team size is just short of about 50 people. That includes some freelancers and some outsourcers. We track things as a way to try and check ourselves in terms of revenue per employee or revenue per FTE. I make sure that we're accounting for folks that we otherwise would have had to hire. You know, sometimes it's preferential to do business with partners externally, agencies or what have you. So when we do that, we try to account for those folks in our kind of FTE calculations as well. So we're around 50 today.
Mm. Okay, thanks for that. And sure. You had a, like you've already spoken about, quite a diverse career journey. And at the point where you joined Kuru, you were quite established and had a great CV behind you. So I guess that you had options. What drew you into Kuru? Where was the opportunity as you saw it?
Yeah, I've said this to our CEO along the way, that the things that really spoke to me from Kuru's perspective, I feel like the brand has incredible potential. I've often said that I feel like we're one of the best kept secrets in Salt Lake City, right? Salt Lake City is really becoming well known as a tech hub. And the focus of that, when you go and do research on Salt Lake, is very B2B SaaS oriented, right? There's tons and tons of money flowing into that side of the kind of marketing space. When I left Sears, the job that I moved into, I really, really enjoyed that. And I missed e-commerce, like actually working with physical product, pulling levers, the direct to consumer or the B2C, I guess, piece of the puzzle was really a part that I missed quite a bit. I led a much larger team at that role in between Sears and here at Kuru. But the thing that I really, really missed the most was the idea of being kind of hardcore e-commerce. And the direct-to-consumer piece was very attractive as well. There was a stint where I led a more of a traditional e-com retailer. And boy, that's just not a place that I want to really enjoy living. You know, in fact, you're trying to compete on whether it's be price or some other thing, that just there's too many constraints, right? The fact that we own the brand and we are completely responsible for architecting the experience that our consumers have with the brand every step of the way, every step of the journey, that was very attractive. So I felt like Kuru had an incredible opportunity to grow, and that's proven to be true the last 2 years. And so we're really excited and very high on the prospects of the brand on a go-forward basis.
Mm. And how would the CEO, if you were in his shoes, describe your role, just to give us an idea of the kind of bandwidth and things that fall under you?
Yeah, so we run the business using a system called EOS. Some of your listeners may be familiar with that. EOS stands for the Entrepreneurial Operating System. It's based on a book called Traction that you can find on Amazon or wherever you get your hard copies or your digital versions of books these days. EOS, the system, believes in kind of a two-headed monster when it comes to running the business. They refer to them as the visionary and the integrator. So the visionary's primary responsibilities are kind of big relationships, big thinking, culture, vision, where are we taking the business? It's oftentimes the founder, though not always the founder. I view myself, and he would describe me as kind of an operator. I report to him and everyone else in the business reports to me. So I think of myself, and he would probably agree, that I'm kind of an orchestra conductor, right? We're setting rocks, big projects and big focus areas for every employee inside the business on a quarterly basis. We're making sure that all of those projects are aligned with each other and are aligned to the larger growth strategy of the business.
Right. Okay. So you've got really quite a fluid role by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
There's no kind of set job description.
Yeah, which is a good fit for me, because I get bored really easily, as you can tell from my career path, right?
So. Yeah. I mean, one of my later questions is, it's somewhat apparent that you have an entrepreneurial spirit. And one of the things I wanted to understand about you is whether you had ever ventured out on your own, whether you'd felt like that was something you might do in the future, or whether you just feel more comfortable operating within an existing ecosystem. Has that crossed your mind, like in terms of going out and doing a venture for yourself?
Yeah, it has. I did one small thing back in Chicago. There was a business right before Sears that I had kind of launched. I wasn't very serious about it. It was very kind of small ball. It was a digital marketing training course or series of courses. The general idea was, where do you really go to get to learn these things that you and I and so many other folks really know, right? Every one of us, if you polled every one of your guests, I'm sure learned different things in different ways from a digital marketing perspective. The old traditional ways are really not equipped to keep up with the pace of innovation on that front. And I've never been a huge fan of online learning for whatever reason. I'm just a firm believer that you get more out of an in-person interaction. And so the general thought was to pull in people that I was really close friends with, pay them really well to spend 2 hours training a small cohort of people, no more than 50 people in a room at any given point in time. That was kind of under the banner of my digital consultancy back in Chicago that has since been shut down when I joined Sears. But I still think that there's potential there. And I see it a little bit in some of the communities that I'm a part of, like e-commerce fuel. It's a little more, that idea was a little more kind of programmatically interesting to me. And I've toyed with the idea of maybe starting an e-com brand on the side as kind of a side hustle, but it seems so much work. I mean, I'm a workaholic as it is. And the other idea that I've kind of been toying with is, do I just go buy a small business and run it with my kids? I have three teenage boys, teach them some life skills along the way. It would be kind of fun to assign work and assign projects and review it at home when I get home at the end of the day. There's been a few ideas, kind of seeds that are somewhat germinating in the back of the old noggin. We'll see if anything ever comes of it.
Okay, cool. And before we just jump into the Twitter segment, can you tell us a bit about the macro objectives for the brand? Just a high level overview of sort of what the next 18 months might look like for you guys.
Yeah, it's mostly a responsible growth, I would say. We're planning lots and lots of different tests. We view everything as a test. We're going to be jumping into our first direct mail catalog in Q3, Q4 this year. We have plans to test programmatic or connected TV ads. Any and everything that we can do to make sure that we're helping more and more people with foot pain. that's the real kind of driving force. Our big, hairy, audacious goal is really a number of customers that we want to help with foot pain in the next 10 years. It's in the millions. And it's an aggregate number from the beginning of the business through that time frame. So it really is all about how do we help more people more frequently with reclaiming their lives. You know, we get these reviews pretty consistently from customers that have the tenor of, oh my gosh, you have changed my life. You made it possible for me to do X again. Whatever the thing that, you know, they really missed doing. We'd like to think that our mission is to help our customers find their potential, passion, and purpose, and kind of to reclaim those that portion of their lives that's been missing. Because imagine for those that haven't had this kind of foot pain, imagine every single step you take being in incredible pain. It's very debilitating and very limiting. And so we hear that kind of feedback pretty regularly from our customers, and it really is the thing that drives us forward.
It's a good goal to have. I like that you've got a physical number to aim at as well. That's I like when goals are specifically targeted. So it sounds like you said the word growth then. There does seem to be two camps forming, profitability and growth camp. It's a great time if you have the capital to be and resources to be able to make the land grabs over the next sort of 12 months and gain market share while others maybe are hunkering down. Is that how you see it? Are you taking an aggressive stance there and you have the ability to go after growth? Or are you still being a bit cautious?
Yeah, I think it's funny that you say that. The way that you defined it was growth or profitability. I've said for a long time that you're either oriented for one or the other, right? Sometimes you get lucky and a growth pathway that you discover, or you discover a new way of doing it, drives both growth and profitability incrementally to one another. But I like to think of it as a spectrum, right? You're either oriented this way or you're oriented the other direction. I like to think of us as kind of balanced in the middle. We are profitable and have been profitable virtually every month since I've joined the business. Even in those independent months where you go, oh my gosh, things aren't really, it's in the slow period from our seasonality perspective. But the focus has always been on profitable growth for us. And the growth that we experienced the last 2 years came at a time when it was still very profitable. And so we don't think of ourselves as the type of business that is probably ever going to go raise a bunch of venture capital and push for growth at any cost. We see those, I refer to them as the DTC darlings, right? They're all of the brands that get all the coverage and all the media. And not a single one of them is profitable. You know, for some reason, we've got this, that we've fetishized this notion of growth at all costs and how a raising a fund round is newsworthy. I don't like to think that way. And neither does our founder. And so we are completely aligned in that way. Even the businesses that are profitable don't nearly get the coverage of the ones that aren't profitable, which I just find really fascinating. Take someone like Figs, for example, that sells nursing scrubs. Incredible business and profitable. They get a fraction of the attention that someone like an Allbirds or a Warby Parker get in the space. And I find that really, really curious. I would love to find a way to change it, but I'm one person and one person with not a very big connection to the media space. So I don't really understand how or why that's the proclivity, but it is. It's just undeniable.
I wonder if it's something to do with companies that are more public with their financials. We began this and you're private and fair enough keeping your financials locked down. So maybe it's something to do with the exposure to the numbers. If they had that exposure, maybe they'd be writing more headlines. I don't know.
Sure.
That's an interesting. Yeah. So I wanted to just jump into some of your tweets because I thought it's fitting. That's where I see you most frequently. Mm-hmm. And whenever I see your picture, I always read the tweet and it's always worth the read. So I just wanted to go over a couple of them. I kind of randomly hand selected them. So one, you said we built a custom post-purchase survey for that purpose that we've been using. The plan is to take SMS and pulse semi-frequently over time. And I think this was coming off the back of another tweet regarding post-purchase. So what was that about? Can you dig into that a little bit?
Yeah. So if you think about our brand, or if you go to our website, the easiest way to think about our brand is to go to our navigational menu, right? So it shows you kind of the ways that we think about segmenting customer groups and the ways we think about educating customers about how Kuru can help them with their problem. So if you nav today over the men's or the women's shoes, there's three or four different columns of ways that you can find our product segments, our category pages are in Shopify. Once we get migrated, it'll be a collections page, right? So there's, you can shop by a specific type of foot pain. You can shop by a specific activity. You can shop by a specific career. And we think about those three major groups in particular, because those are kind of entry points that customers may identify and have a specific job that they're trying to solve for, right? People that are on their feet all day for work tend to have more foot fatigue and more foot pain than those that sit in front of a desk like myself, right? So people that are working retail, or they're working restaurant, or they're working in a warehouse, or they're a delivery driver, or they're a teacher, or they're in the healthcare profession, people that are just constantly on tile floors or concrete floors, it takes some wear and tear on your feet. And so we've created and architected some small experience where we built up category pages with some content at the top of that page to showcase how these specific types of crew footwear shoes can help with that specific job or that career. But it's also, we think of everything through this jobs to be done framework, right? People that have specific types of foot pain, whether that be plantar fasciitis or bunions or heel pain or high arches or whatever, we've kind of talked to our customers and talked to experts to try and curate the types of shoes that we think are best suited for that specific type of job to be done. We believe that that's a great pathway into the brand. The post-purchase survey element of that was what we really wanted to do. You know, all of those recommendations for the most part were based off of surveying our customer experience experts who deal with customers every day, as well as our product folks that actually built the product. The thought was, why not survey our customers? You know, if Finn comes to our website and buys a pair of Kurus, why not immediately on the post-purchase pop-up say, hey, thanks for your purchase of the Kuru Adams, right? Please take 10 seconds to share with future purchasers about your purchase of the Adams. Did you buy these shoes to solve a specific type of foot pain today? Check all that apply. Did you buy them to do a specific activity, walking, running, hiking, you know, beach activity, gardening, whatever? Check all that apply. And did you buy them specifically to wear at a specific job? Check any or all that apply. And the notion was just at that point of checkout to do that at scale and then to eventually feed that product data back within the PDP. So imagine an experience in the future, 3 months down the line, you go and you navigate to that men's Adams page, and below the checkout button or the add to cart button, you see a survey result, you know, a bar graph that says, here's the top three types of body pain that customers have recently purchased the Adams for. So that was the initial thought. We actually executed that and still execute it. We're capturing that data at checkout, not only to share that back with customers, but eventually to share it back with our product teams as well. Hey, you built this for this purpose. Here's what people are actually buying it for, right? Kind of close that product loop. It's a really powerful idea. The main problem was when we went to go and turn that on inside PDP, the same two or three jobs in each category just were consistent across every shoe. So it became less valuable at the customer level. But the next, I think, iteration of that was to ask that question via SMS, right? Hey, you told us, thanks for your recent purchase of the Adams. Did you buy them to solve a specific type of foot pain? Please acknowledge, you know, or please select one from the drop-down list. And then the follow-up could be, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad was that foot pain when you went to buy the Adams? And now we can use that as a means to try to quantify the impact that the specific style is having on the specific type of foot pain over time. So that lends itself into potential claims that we can make within PDP. You know, Adam helps at 62% of customers reduce foot pain by at least, you know, 5x or whatever, you know, whatever that data, however we want to make that visible. That's the interesting, I think, evolution of that as an idea. But it really has been this whole idea of how do we best serve our customers throughout and every step of the journey. And that's just another means. And then, you know, periodically pulsing that customer. Hey, it's 3 weeks later. You told us that your foot pain when you bought the Adams was this. You've probably had a chance to break them in by now. Rate your foot pain today, right? And then keeping that as a pulse to every 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks without being too intrusive, to track how we're actually living up to the expectations that we set during the purchase journey.
Mm. And if you collected enough data, you could start to become proactive. If you knew that men of the age of 36 to 45 were buying the Atom and tended to buy it because they had a knee injury from running, you could target men who are 29 to 36 and say, you may well experience an injury. And if you do, this is the best shoe to recover you. And they, you know, that is kind of cool.
Yeah. And imagine a world where you've got a robust content strategy as well, you know, whether that be communicating. I mean, we do a fair amount of this now, but it's not as robust as we'd like it to be. Here's some stretches that you can, you know, do on a daily basis to make sure that you're doing everything you can to mitigate the foot pain that you've told us that you're experiencing. Right. Or here's, you know, an entire health oriented foot health program that you can kind of sign up for, eventually living in an app or something, of, you know, kind of next gen. We need to walk before we run. So I view this as like we're in the crawling stage, and I think SMS has the potential to really take it to the next level for us.
I like the idea of a campaign where you're targeting people who've never purchased from you before, who maybe don't have an injury, and your messaging is somewhere around the fact that it's like, we want to keep you out of our shoes for as long as possible. So here's some things you could be doing right now. And then at some point in the future, when they pick an injury up, they just snap into, you know, oh, I know these shoes are going to, but almost being, you know, the antagonist in that situation and being like, we don't want you to buy our products until you, ah, oh, you've got an injury. Yeah, interesting. Okay. Spinning up a new factory partner is hard.
Yeah, that's, it's especially hard when the way you make shoes is different from everybody else, right? The fact that we embed this technology, our shoes are not made like anyone else's. I'll give you one really good example. I wish I had an example with me. So when shoes are manufactured, they're manufactured around the last, which is a kind of a shape and form of a human foot, right? If you think about every other pair of shoes, no matter whether they're high performance or not, the vast, vast, vast majority of them are built around a last that's flat on the bottom. It just makes it much easier from a construction technique perspective. The question I have for you is the human foot flat on the bottom? It's not, right? It's rounded. The heel is a round thing. Our lasts are rounded on the bottom, just like a human foot. When you put pressure down on that rounded bottom, it has a tendency to wobble. The reason that's flat, it makes perfect sense if you're thinking about manufacturing shoes. Everybody else builds them that way because it's easier and faster and less problematic. Our lasts are built like in the exact same shape as a human foot. And so that makes the construction technique and the application of all of the elements much more difficult. And so they're more expensive to make, frankly, and that getting a new factory partner totally up to speed and ramped up on all the intricacies of what it takes to build a pair of Kurus can be a real challenge. The other thing that had certainly crept up and bit everybody, or certainly bit us, is in 2021, the vast majority of factories in Vietnam were inaccessible due to COVID restrictions. And so this is a factory that we were supposed to launch a year and a half ago, probably. And things were just delayed. It's been very difficult to kind of get that up and running. And so it's one of those intricacies that, you know, most people don't think about unless they're living in the e-com space and the D2C world. It can be challenging. It can be really challenging.
Yeah. And were you spinning up a new factory because of the increase in demand and growth? Or is it just your moving partners? What was the reason for actually creating
it? Yeah, it's a variety of things for sure. We're always on the lookout to find great new partners. And this was something that actually a lot of the strategy and the decision making predated my arrival 3 years ago. So we had been working on the new designs. We've got a new version of some of our best selling shoes coming out through this partner. They should be launching in the next couple months or so. It's a very exciting time. But it was just time to rethink where they were made and how they were made in terms of these, especially this new design. It was a perfect cut over time.
Okay. Being great at demand capture can only help you grow so far. Eventually, one must start creating demand if growth is a mandate. Speaking from experience.
Yeah. really close to home for us. You know, we've, as I mentioned, grown really, really rapidly the last 2 years, and we did it primarily by maximizing demand capture. One thesis that I've had for a long time around the business was, when we were measuring everything via last click, a lot of our top of funnel campaigns were not really backing out. Not a big surprise there, right? So you're not driving the return on the investment that you'd like to see or the return on the ad spend that you'd like to see. One big question that I had when I had surveyed the landscape and looked at all these other direct-to-consumer brands that were spending lots and lots of money, like 80 to 90% of their budget was spent on Facebook or Instagram. And we were the opposite. We were spending all of our budget in Google and with Microsoft, 10% maybe in Facebook. The big question really was, is there a reason for that? Like, are we doing it wrong is the big kind of open question. Or is there lots of opportunity there that we're just, or is it a unique attribute of our business that is driving that outcome? Once we got spun up with our new data stack and our partner with Rockerbox really understood kind of multi-touch attribution, it became pretty clear that we in fact had opportunity in the top of funnel in the paid social space. And then it was time for us to start thinking about how do we get into a demand gen mode and not just demand capture. Back to the original thesis, the big question was, is there something about our business, whether that because we solve a real job to be done, you know, that job to be done creates incredible swaths of keyword driven search intent, right? It's very high intent search volume that we were very good at capitalizing on through paid search, through shopping engines, and other kind of more bottom of funnel tactics and channels. And that was a major driver of our growth. But again, in partnership with Rockerbox, we've definitely identified that there's opportunity to move up the funnel. We've actually just recently signed on with a new agency. We're really excited to be working with them. And we're kind of moving down toward that more traditional direct-to-consumer or D2C kind of roadmap or marketing plan. So it's exciting to test how fast we can scale that, but scale to do so profitably. So that's kind of what that tweet was referencing, is like our opening of our eyes to the fact that there was definitely potential in paid social as a generalized channel to raise awareness and produce incremental revenue for the business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So sounds like lots of opportunity there to be captured, but I get it. I've worked with brands on the Google organic and paid side, and they do really well, especially as you mentioned, when there's high intent search terms and lots of them. Just being great at capitalizing on those can be so powerful. We do a rolling 5-quarter forecast every month, reflecting back on the last 90-day actuals and forecasting out 12 months forward. Can you just explain that strategy?
Yeah. So when we go through our planning process, we create an annual profit plan. We specifically call it a profit plan because it's designed to generate profits. And it's planning out for the year where we think we will land. The problem is it's a guess. It's a wild, hairy guess. And the only thing that we know about our plans and even our forecasts is they're going to be wrong. We just don't know how wrong they're going to be and in which direction. For the last 2 years, almost every reforecast I put together was wrong on the low side. We just kept kind of driving forward and driving forward. And so late last year, we instituted this new process that we call the 5QF, the 5-quarter forecast, where we every month we reflect back on what we did in the last 90 days and we forecast out the next 12 months. And that gives us greater visibility into where we think we're going to need to be from an inventory perspective. So it's a major driver of our inventory purchase strategy. And it's it, even though we have a plan and we lock in, like here's the line plan from our men's and women's shoes perspective, we're constantly adjusting that based on how we're actually performing in the marketplace. Just because we had a plan to launch this shoe at this given month doesn't mean we're going to stick to that, right? And that's become even more of a driver or a big need for us as the lead times have extended. You know, what used to be 95 days from factory to warehouse is now 120. It's just insane how long this has become. When we place a PO, we're expecting delivery about 5 months from now, which means you just need to be more and more accurate, if at all possible, on your forecasting, sell-through forecasting, what a new style is going to do from a sell-through perspective, based on the things we historically have known about our customers. So creating these feedback loops is ever more important inside the business. And it's become a very data-driven exercise. So what happens when we do the 5QF is marketing comes with a channel level forecast of, hey, here's what we forecasted last month, and here's the ways in which we are wrong. And we look at it on a click, a conversion rate, like every single aspect of every channel was forecast originally. That was the driver of last month's forecast. And so we revisit, how close were we? How accurate were we? And then our demand planner does a product level forecast as well. And he's constantly refining his models. And the two kind of meet in the middle at the end of the day and say, okay, here's where we think we're going to land this month, next month, the next month out. And then that informs and becomes the foundation, the basis of our next year profit plan. So in the next 45 days or so, we're going to start the process of training all the different department heads on the way that we're planning to do our profit plan for next year, for 2023 already. So we're getting in front of that process. That'll be a 60 to 90 day process. We'll lock all that down come end of November, probably. But yeah, it's an ever evolving process where we are talking cross-functionally. Leaving all the egos at the door. It's not about who was right or who was wrong. It's about understanding, like, in what direction were we wrong and why? Because we know we're going to be wrong. So there's no finger pointing. It's not an exercise to try and hold people accountable, other than the fact that we're just trying to learn from what is actually happening inside the business. And the more data we throw into that system, the better we get at it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough, really tough thing to get right, especially with sizes and variants, seasonal shoes. You've got a lot on your plate with that.
It's incredible. It's a lot different than someone with 5 SKUs, right? I mean, we have thousands of SKUs in this business, and it is a real challenge.
Yeah. And when it goes wrong spectacularly, I can imagine. You either end up out of stock or with just tons of warehouses full of shoes.
We've been on both sides of that.
Yeah. So you've been down the fractional route. And when we say fractional, sort of part employee, it's not part-time employing, is it? It's sort of full-time, but well, you explain it. What does fractional staff mean for Kuru?
Yeah. So we're working with a fractional CFO today. So he's in the office a couple of days a week. He gives us probably 10 hours a week. He's in our senior leadership meeting. And we work with a person in that capacity because it just doesn't make a ton of sense for our size to be working with a full-time CFO just yet. We're pretty close. So we typically do that for a couple of reasons. One is looking at what we really need out of that role. So it's almost a discovery process for us. You know, should we go down the path and post a role for a full-time CFO? What are the things we're going to look for? What are the attributes? What are the specific aspects of the role that we really want out of that type of person? So that kind of fractional executive leadership is available in a lot of different, you know, almost any C-suite role you can think of. There are people out there doing that type of function. I remember actually about 6 or 8 years ago, I had a friend trying to talk me into becoming a part-time or a fractional CMO for a bunch of different companies. The one that I've never really understood is COOs. That feels like a thing that you're either in it or you're not. And the kind of a, but there are people that do it, and I'm sure they do it very successfully. So I kind of scratch my head and wonder, like, how in depth really can you be in running the everyday aspects of a full operation inside of a business? It might be a much smaller company than ours that would hire for that. But that's kind of typically the answer is that it's, imagine someone who would typically hire, an agency, and the reason that the rationale they're giving for why they're hiring the agency is because they're not just quite big enough to be able to hire a full-time person to do that job, right? We're going to, out of the agency, we're going to get some time out of 4 or 5 different roles that are going to serve our needs better. This is a similar approach, but just with a typically senior leader of one type or another, although there are fractional heads of growth as well that are more sort of director level or VP level employees along the way.
Yeah, I like it. I do like it. And it's nice to hear that it's been successful for you. So we had another Sean on the show not too long ago who had the approach to business that it was better to find an established category with competition and find a point of difference than it was to sit and try and think of a completely new product and create your new market and educate your customers and have no competition. That was Ridge Wallet. And you also tweeted, build an incredible product that solves a real job to be done while filling a functional, emotional, and social need for your customer. You gave the example of Yeti coolers and We Are Figs. And it seems like you've done the same thing with Kuru, found a point of difference in an established market. So what was that tweet about? And do you have any other brands that fit that definition that come to mind?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a huge admirer of Sean's. I've talked to him a couple times, and I that tweet in particular, I can't remember the circumstances, but I do agree that it's a little bit self-fulfilling, right? It's a little bit of a, I'm busy patting myself on the back, kind of breaking my elbow here, because clearly we do solve a real job to be done. And I think that's a point of differentiation, but so does On Running, you know, and so do all these other footwear brands. There are dozens and dozens. Allbirds serves a great purpose. They built an incredible brand. You know, I don't think that necessarily they solve a real functional job to be done, more of a societal and a branding job to be done. But they built an incredible, powerful brand, and the design of the shoes, there's a design red thread that kind of works its way through, you know, a pair of Allbirds the minute you see them. Right. So I'm a huge admirer of what they've done from a product line perspective. I think of that as kind of a pathway to that balanced growth that's profitable, right? Of if you can really solve that job to be done that your customers have. The other one that I guess that probably comes to mind might be like Simple Modern. You know, it's just a thing of beauty that also is highly functional, that you can tell from a mile away exactly what brand it is, right? So there's this kind of mix of functional and social. I mean, my wife loves them because they fit in the cup holder inside of her SUV, right?
Like I don't know if you can read my mind, but that is the episode that's coming out this Thursday. Is Mark from Simple Modern. So you will get his take.
Huge admirer of the brand that they built too. And they've done it in a different way. It just goes to show that there's so many ways that you can build a brand today in this day and age, right? We don't sell on Amazon at all. And they're a powerhouse in selling through Amazon. And so is Sean. I mean, Ridge Wallet, you know, that's one of the things that really introduced me to Sean originally was a tweet probably 18 months ago that said something along the lines of, you know, they used to think of Amazon as the bad guy and they just put a focus on it, decided to figure it out. And his mind had been changed just in the last 12 months about how Amazon had a potential for them as a brand and a company. So, it's interesting. You know, every company does the things that they think are the right thing for them and for their customers.
Mm. Could you be swayed by Amazon?
I am not the biggest fan. I'm a huge fan as a consumer and not a big fan as a business. I think there's equal amounts of risk and opportunity there. And we have chosen to avoid it due to the risks, honestly. It's just... there's no doubt that there's incremental volume sitting there waiting to be taken. But that doesn't mean it's a reason to go do it. And we've chosen the opposite path for the time being.
Mm, okay. Well, that brings us nicely into the next segment, which is talking a little bit about channels with a focus on brick and mortar retail. So could you just give us a high level overview of your kind of main D2C channels at the moment and also any wholesale channels or retail channels?
Yeah, we don't do any wholesale or retail today and have no plans to do so in the near or medium term. we have a small showroom that sits in front of corporate that's 1% or 2% of revenue. Annually, we'll do a warehouse sale. That is kind of the only place you can get really steeply discounted Kuru product. That's in person only here in our corporate headquarters, or that's where it was last year. We're selecting a location for this year's sale that we're going to do in the fall instead of the spring. And then everything else is through our owned and operated website. So our direct to consumer website at kurufootwear.com is really the primary place to transact with us today.
Mm-hmm. And I know just from the frequency of your tweets about retail that it's either been a conversation that you've been having internally or it's a conversation you've been having in your own mind about opening up possibly your own Kuru chain of stores, nationally and internationally. So is that something that you're just toying with, you're just trying to figure out at the moment?
I think so. It was a rock of mine from last quarter to get aligned with the senior leadership team. I'd say we're not still fully aligned, but we're more aligned than we were. And so that series of tweets that you saw was a call out to in the wild to try to hunt down other brands that have been doing their own owned and operated brick and mortar locations. I've had a bunch. I had four or five, maybe six really good conversations with other operators that have gone down that path. Actually listened to a podcast this weekend and identified someone else I'm dying to kind of connect with and learn from them. So it's definitely on our, you know, we will eventually probably do this roadmap. The timing is still a little bit suspect on the specifics. I would prefer to do it sooner rather than later. I think there's another faction that we're trying to really align on. What are the things that we want to really understand or that we really have nailed, that we view as kind of the precursors before we go out into retail? My thought is more, what are the things that if we didn't my thought is we're going to eventually do this. I would rather take the lens of we're definitely going to do it. Let's figure out what are the things that if we didn't really understand it yet, it would be a game changer. Maybe that's just two ways to identify the same set of things. But I think of it as more of like a foregone conclusion that we will eventually do it. Than an assumption that we wouldn't unless we knew these things, right? If there are one or two things that are just absolute, we have to understand this or this or this before we go do that, and then let's agree on what those things are so we can go understand them. Some of it has to do with kind of roles and responsibilities and making sure we've got the right people inside the business to probably support that type of initiative. I could see that being a big precursor. Or contingency that we'd want to have filled. And a lot of it has to do with just really having the brand nailed the way we want to have it nailed. And so my default is that we can probably learn some of that along the way and maybe make some shifts and go down a store redesign or two along the way. You know, one head of retail that I talked to made the comment that you'll never feel like you're ready. If you're going to wait till you feel like you're ready, you'll probably never do it. And I could see that being a thing that would hold some brands back. And I'm more of the kind of let's jump in and figure it out as we go and understand the risk and try to mitigate those risks as you do it. But based on the conversations that I've had, it feels like an incredible opportunity for us and probably one of our biggest opportunities. So that to me is why I'm maybe one or two steps further ahead than maybe some of the others in the leadership group.
You said the word risk there a few times. What do you see the risks of moving into retail as?
Well, I think there's some dramatic operational risks in terms of sunk costs. You know, it's a very costly endeavor or can be a very costly endeavor depending on how scrappy you want to be with the build out and the commitment that you're making to, you know, long-term lease terms and things of that nature. So I think it's the other big risk is it's just such a different animal. You know, it's almost like running a different business. Figuring out how to hire and staff and serve customers in that environment, it's a lot different than everything we're doing online, right? And so you have to really be committed and have the capital to be able to do it. I mean, there's things that we would have to learn in terms of how do you inventory a store? Do you run the whole line? Do you run a portion of the line? Do you run just a couple of the course styles or colors within each major style? Like there's lots of different ways I could envision spinning up a store. The other piece is just because it's stuff that we don't know, where do you find the right expertise to bring into the business to help consult and really share their years and decades of experience along the way, right? It's just a different animal. And I think nailing that right and really also understanding how the brick and mortar experience complements or is different from or maybe completely unique to the online customer journey and customer experience, right? What makes someone more willing to walk into a store as opposed to trying something online? How do these two things peacefully coexist? How do you attribute dollars that you're spending in generalized brand marketing to both the store level as well as the online experience? There's a lot of open questions for sure that remain. And one I think we'll probably get answers to over the next 12 to 18 months and hopefully, you know, move forward with some project or a plan to plant a flag, you know, put a stake in the ground eventually somewhere out there and say, this is what we're marching toward. Here's the deadline for when we're going to do our first store. And then here's the plan moving forward from there.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing this beautiful triangle with three corners emerge in retail, where I'm seeing some really explosive and interesting adaptations of what retail can be, which is coupling a store with a physical premises that provides a service, and also making that premises the content machine for the brand. So I'll give you an example. There's a brand called Alphalete, who are a gymwear brand, and they have their showrooms for two or three different brands next to the gym, which their customers frequent regularly. And they shoot all of their content with their customers and the owners of the brand. And they form this sort of nice trifecta of everything feeds everything else. And there's a number of different examples of that happening in retail, where it becomes a daily experience or a weekly experience, where retail is actually just added on rather than just being a physical store. And with a product like yourselves, you know, physiotherapy and other things like that, I can see it possibly having that kind of an attachment. So I get, you know, there's many things to consider, and retail is actually becoming a bit more dynamic in the way that it's being utilized. Interesting stuff. Okay. I thought you were going to be on the verge of opening up stores. I thought that's why the way you were, where you were coming from. But
yeah, it's I wish that it were so, right? We're definitely, even when I, that was a rock for me to kind of get my arms around it and get aligned with the senior leadership team. Even then, had we agreed to move forward, my thought was to put some money in budget next year with the intent of like standing up our first store Q2 of 2024. I mean, it takes, you know, what I've been told talking to some folks is you plan about a year to like select the location, conduct the build out, you know, hire the team, train the team, inventory the store. Like, it just takes time. You know, it's a big project. And so nailing that the first time, we're going to get some stuff wrong. We're definitely going to screw some things up. And so, but incrementally, it feels like an incredible opportunity for me. I feel like, you know, the folks that I've talked to, I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of what it could mean for the top line of the business. And the dynamics change dramatically too. You know, because you're trying the shoes on in the store, you'll likely experience a small fraction of the typical return rate that you experience from online. How does that play into our favor? Does it or doesn't it not? You know, how would you architect that journey in a way that's uniquely different? What's the post-purchase follow-up from a retail store versus an online store, right? There's just so many interesting questions that, we wouldn't even really begin to have answers to just yet, but it's a fun process to kind of think through. And once we get the go ahead, it's got to start figuring those things out. So it's going to take time.
And what's your reservation around moving into wholesale with another established distributor?
I think it's primarily today the big risk is, again, it's a whole nother business, right? Like understanding how that works, being able to support the growth of that as a series of channels. I think the other big piece is you just lose. It's the same thing that's troubling with Amazon. You lose the direct connection with the customer. D2C is special and different in that we get to have these one-to-one conversations. I get to collect zero party data. I get to SMS you and ask you about your foot pain. The minute we go into a Nordstrom or an REI, we lose that. Now you're dealing with a buyer. You're dealing with a merchant. And that's a completely different experience, one that has tremendous potential to grow the top line of the business. It all gets back to that. Are you oriented for growth or are you oriented for efficiency? And if the mix is this kind of hybrid approach, not saying that wholesale can't be profitable, because I do believe that it can. It just creates a different set of challenges. And so if you're going to think about, oh, we're going to be in retail eventually, the question then becomes, should it be an owner and operated model or should it be a wholesale model? And if you're a brand that's more oriented for growth, maybe wholesale is the right answer, right? I watch these CPG brands getting placement inside Target. It's exciting, right? It's an incredible win when you get to go back home and talk about those things. But with that comes its own sort of risks in terms of things that didn't get sold through and get pushed back onto your inventory stores. I mean, there's so much to really understand about it. And, you know, I think the other thing is that we started out as originally a wholesale model. And when those retailers pulled those orders in the great financial crisis, it became a bit of a point of pride and a sticking point for our founder that, you know what, I'm going to make this without them. So I think that's kind of another, you know, situation. And the other thing that he's told me, which is really interesting, if you think about a traditional footwear retailer in particular, you know, in the industry, some folks call it sit and fit, right? If you go through those types of partnerships, one example I've thought of for a while here is, you know, what if we just found all the specialty running stores and positioned ourselves as a recovery shoe for runners? If you're not selling in that environment, it's all your fault because you didn't drive your customers into their store. If you're selling like hotcakes, it's because they're the greatest salespeople in the world. They understand their customers beautifully. It's a no-win situation, right? It's never that you're building a great product that actually helps their customers solve a real job to be done. It's all about how incredible they are, how terrible you are. So like, why not just control the entirety of the experience from end to end, every step of the journey?
Mm-hmm. I like it. It also, I guess, depends on the end goal for the company. Are you looking to sell it in 3 years, or are you looking to hold on to it and build value over time? Makes some of those decisions more transparent. So a really quick one to run through is, I just wanted to go through my purchase journey that I use, my purchase journey framework. And I appreciate that might not be the same purchase journey framework that you use. And stop along the way at each of those stops. And if you could give me some insights into some of the strategies, tactics, channels, anything that you've got that you can give on each of those points, would be great. So if I was a new customer and I'll give you the stops first off, just so you can have them in the back of your mind. Brand awareness, inspiration, education, consideration, retention, advocacy. So if I was a customer, and where am I likely to first find out about your brand, Kuru?
Probably word of mouth, honestly. I think a lot of our customers are hearing about us from other customers, friends and family. It's either that or probably a Facebook ad or an Instagram ad.
How are you encouraging? Go on.
The third potential for us is in search, right? So if they've got a real problem with maybe they've identified either they've self-diagnosed or they've been to podiatrist and they know that they've got plantar fasciitis. If they run a search for plantar fasciitis problems or shoes for plantar fasciitis, they're going to find Kuru along the way. We're buying ads in Google. We're showing up organically. We're usually embedded in probably half of the listicles that are also performing in SEO as through affiliates or referrals. So it's that kind of shelf play on the search result that is a big potential driver as well for us.
Mm-hmm. So once I found out about you, where am I learning? Where am I getting inspiration from?
Yeah. So the primary method, we have about 160 different pages in what we call our Experts Corner. So those pages were recently overhauled from beginning to end, completely rewritten, redesigned, relaunched. So those pages, some of them are performing in search, but if you land on our website, there's a link in the main nav that says foot pain. Those lead to kind of a hub and spoke approach around all the different educational articles and things of that nature that kind of educate people broadly speaking about the topic that they're looking for and how Kuru can kind of slide in as a potential solution for that problem.
Mm-hmm. Anywhere outside of your website?
Email is another place, but not really much. There's definitely an opportunity there for us to play stronger in the PR game, for sure. It's been a big weakness of ours.
Okay. And from an education perspective, you mentioned obviously you've got these pages. Is there anything else that you have that if I'm not ready to buy it, I just want to know a bit more about how your shoes help? Is there anywhere else that I can get that information?
I think customer reviews are another big potential solution there in terms of the emotional punch of so many of the reviews that we have. You know, we never delete a review from our product. We definitely order them. So the most recent 5 stars are at the top, but every single review is there for everyone to see.
Mm, I like how my brands do that. I think that's so authentic and actually very helpful. Okay, so how about consideration? So I'm over the hump and maybe I've added a couple of things to my basket, but I'm not quite, I'm either on the line of checking out or how would you get me over the line? Do you have retargeting funnels, things like that?
We do, but they're not as robust as you might expect. We don't do coupon codes. And so there's, we don't do a, hey, come back and get 10% off or $10 off your checkout. We do have an offer for new customers that, we've kind of played around with. All of this is very much in play right now as we make our way from Magento to Shopify. So we're in the process of a big migration project that'll land us with our first Shopify site in September. And so all the tech stack is being kind of reconsidered along the way, which also means we're open to testing new potential offers and things of that nature. But one of the things I did 3 years ago was I removed the coupon code from our checkout flow. It just felt like we were leaking margin. So there's no place for any individual customer to get treated differently from every other customer today. There's those kind of offers to push you across the line really don't exist very much. There's some retargeting happening within Facebook and search, but for the most part, that's it.
This isn't part of this line of questioning, but just one that popped into my head is, mm-hmm. In terms of, things like bundles and things like that. Do you, and also even just expanding out your SKUs into sort of accessory products rather than the main product, maybe socks or, you know, yep. Devices. Is that something you focus on as well, as in maybe getting someone in with a sort of slightly lower cost purchase and then upselling them, or is that not part of the strategy?
We have accessories today, and it's not really a way to get them into the brand per se. It's more of an upsell opportunity or a brand loyalty opportunity. So we have kind of compression oriented socks, and actually there's a redesign that should be going live this week or next with a kind of V2 of our, we call them the Spark. Those socks, I'm really excited to get those onto the site, but we've never really thought, usually it's more of like, you know, buy a pair of shoes, get a pair of socks free. So we'll do kind of a buy one, get, or a gift with purchase type of a mentality rather than getting them into an earlier, a lower price point. We've also talked about some potential product innovation in terms of, can we get a lower cost version of the shoes with maybe a different way of creating the technology to lower the price point, kind of as an entry point into the brand. We're definitely, you know, on the more expensive side. I mean, our top performing sneakers are in the $160 a pair range, which is definitely not cheap. So, you know, there's a question in our minds from a product roadmap perspective of like, can we go build a $90 or $95 pair of sneakers, you know, that would be, that would get you 90% of the performance perhaps, or kind of create an upgrade pathway along the way.
Mm-hmm. And advocacy, you said a lot of word of mouth. How do you encourage that?
Yeah. So we have a refer a friend program today. It's not the best. And I'm really excited for when we get migrated to Shopify. We're also moving to Loyalty Lion to run our points-based loyalty program. And so really excited to have a more holistic, well-architected customer journey that encourages those kind of, you know, hey, send us to a friend and family and you benefit and they benefit. So, It's there today. It's buried in your logged in experience. It's not very pretty. It's, you know, there's lots of opportunity to do a much better job on that front.
Mm-hmm. And do I have you for another couple of minutes, or can I get you in for another 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Because that leads segments so perfectly into a passion that lives deep within me. If anyone has followed me on LinkedIn for anywhere close to a year, you'll understand why. I am not a fan of Magento. We were a Magento agency, partner agency, and in fact, I think we technically still are, for 4 years. At the beginning of those 4 years, Magento was an okay platform. I think that's probably the best I can give it. We were sort of migrating a lot of M1 to M2, Magento 1 to Magento 2, and that was bearable hell. And this is from an agency perspective. And then, you know, more recently, you know, we made the pivot to be a full Shopify agency, and we have just loved it ever since. And we've migrated so many of our clients to Shopify. They love it. And it is just a completely different world. And some of the things we just spoke about, in that purchase journey where you said, you know, it's there, but it's buried, or, you know, that is such a classic sign of Magento being quite a complicated and hands-on resource-intensive experience where you have to just do so many other fucking things before you can even focus on the good stuff. Whereas Shopify is just all about the good stuff. And it's so funny because speaking to someone like yourself, but in the UK, we only work with UK companies at present, and I talk to them about, and they're on Magento, and I speak to them, I say, well, this is what life is like on Shopify. And I genuinely, 50% of the time, have to get Shopify to speak to them directly to make sure that I'm not making it up, because they just cannot fathom. They cannot fathom that life can be that easy on Shopify.
Yeah.
And I sit there and smile. Anyway, enough about me. Why did you guys choose to migrate?
Yeah, it's been a real interesting journey to get to this point. So I would say the primary reason is, we are trying to create a different approach and a different kind of ethos inside the business. And the analogy I keep using is build versus buy. If you spent any time in a big company, you know that you've got this bevy of, you know, developers that are very talented that want to do really cool stuff. And it's a big business question, frankly, of, you know, should we build this internally, which comes along with lots of great reasons why you should do that and lots of bad reasons why maybe you shouldn't, or should we buy a system off the shelf? And that comes with its own set of considerations around, you know, limitations of like, well, it's not really going to serve this aspect of our business need, but you're incentivizing some other company to maintain it and keep it current. And so when I think about the Magento versus Shopify, that's the lens through which I think about it. And we have been on Magento from Magento 1 through Magento 2 for quite some time now. And the main thing that kind of held us back from really looking at Shopify in a hard and fast manner was the experience that you just laid out, which was the upgrade from Magento 1 to Magento 2. Like, it was an absolute shit show. Like, it happened long before I got here, but the PTSD that everyone that was in the business felt associated with that has really prevented us from looking more seriously at Shopify or anything else. Like, whoa, like this is kind of working just fine. I'll also say, when I joined the business in 2019, you know, the internal narrative was like, the site's broken. Like, we got to fix it, or we got to do something else. And that was still holdover 2 years later from the Magento 2 upgrade. So when they moved from Magento 1 to Magento 2, they changed everything all at once. They changed the design. They changed the messaging. They left behind 300 pages of content that were performing in SEO because the internal narrative was they had to move beyond the foot-paying customer into more of a lifestyle brand. They changed development agency. They changed hosting provider. They changed everything. And the project at the end was a little bit rushed because the main project manager at the new agency was getting ready to leave at the end of the year. And so they said, well, we're going to get it. Let's get it launched. So they launched in November 2017. And it was a shit show. It was just really, really bad. The site was down for half the day. Like, conversion rates were down. Site was much slower. Like, trying to debug all this stuff when you changed everything all at once, really, it took a while. And again, even when I walked in, we were experiencing like blue circle checkout from database calls during the checkout flow. Like, products would randomly disappear from our category pages. Like, I had our head of finance periodically, just every hour or so, refreshing the men's category and the women's category, looking for, oh, well, crap, that color just disappeared off the category page. Like, that was the experience inside of the world that I walked into in 2019. We cleaned up some of those basics, and then the narrative was like, hey, this is working just fine. Nobody touch it. Like, don't break anything. I'd say the big catalyst for a real desire to have a bigger conversation about, is Magento the right thing for us? When we had a lot of debt, a technical debt. We were on Magento 2.1 when I walked in 2019, and it was long past time to upgrade. And the upgrade project from 2.1 to 2.3 took 56 weeks of work. Now, we were also allowing other upgrades and fixes and things along the way and debugs. But that alone, there were lots of reasons. I wrote a sort of really deep, rich kind of after action review looking at like, hey, why did it take this long? Well, there's this reason and this reason and this reason and this reason. One of them was because we had decided to build our own RMA system. In a classic sort of build versus buy conundrum, we had brought in, you know, Returnly or whoever it was 3-4 years ago. And everyone in the business was like, whoa, that looks really cool. And the senior developer was like, hey, I can build that for a lot less. And it should only take me 6 weeks. Like, why would we pay them 50 grand a year or whatever it was? And it took 6 months. And the module that was built on top of, when we went from 2.1 to 2.3, everything had to be rebuilt from scratch and basically refactored, because that core, you know, underlying functionality was completely revamped to support 2.3. And so that, like, in a nutshell, is the build versus buy mentality. Like, oh, it's a really slick return process. I just went through it this morning. I bought a pair of our brand new colors of Fluxes, and I'm a wide foot, and I was hoping I could fit in it. I can't. I went through it this morning. It's incredible. Like, it's very slick and very smooth. But it's a pain to keep up to date, and it takes lots and lots of effort from an internal development resource. And, you know, now that person, if they were to leave, all that knowledge is gone, right? So I think we're moving very strongly toward this buy mentality of, like, let's just get stuff off the shelf that does enough of the what we need it to do. And, like, e-commerce does not have to be hard. Why do we continue to make it so hard? And so I'm fully aware, actually, Sean, and I've had this conversation, Sean Frank, in the past. I'm fully aware that I'm heading into this. We are heading in this pathway where we're all excited to almost put ourselves directly into a straitjacket and say, like, the bar has got to be really, really high if you want to mess with code. Like, just let it be. Like, wouldn't it be cool if, yeah, okay, it would be cool, but we don't need to do it. Like, is it really going to drive results for the business or not? And 3 years from now, we will probably be pining for the other side of the street and go, gosh, I hate that we're so constrained. Like, wouldn't it be great if we could customize this or this or this in the checkout flow? Trying to find that balance is probably the best of both of all possible worlds. But right now, we're almost forcing on ourselves this idea of constraint. Mm-hmm. Let's just live with something that's simple out of the box. Shopify scales. Like, our CEO has this mantra of, like, we want a stable and scalable tech stack. Magento was, like, mostly that, but kind of neither of that. And, like, depending on the way that you're looking at it, it's like, wow, is it really stable? Like, every single sprint that our development team went through, it feels like 50% of their work is spent fixing bugs that they introduced with the last upgrade, right? Or the last update. So hopefully Shopify goes way, way smoother and all that stuff. It just gets handled for us.
I can't wait. I cannot wait for you to be live on Shopify. The fact that you're still setting your benchmark as stable and scalable is fucking crazy. Like, that should be par for the course. Like, Jesus Christ. Oh, man. Oh, man. You're in for a treat. You're in for such a treat.
You know, and I'll share this. One of the agencies that we interviewed when we were talking with lots of folks trying to figure out who we were going to partner with on the migration, they said, you know, companies that move from Magento to Shopify go from being an IT business to an e-commerce business. And that really, really resonated with me. It's like, oh, man, you mean we can actually focus on just building landing pages at scale and testing new things and really architecting a better journey for our customers? Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. And that is exactly the same thing. My approach is that if you are on Magento, you are opting into being a technology company and a retailer and a merchant and equal balance. There is only, in my mind, a 1% use case for Magento today. And that is if you are a experience driven brand that has deep technical skill sets and deep pockets. And what I mean by that is that your future roadmap revolves heavily around the experience that you create on your website and almost solely on your website. Yep. Where I think brands are going, where I think Shopify's problem is that Shopify is becoming more of just a place of transaction, almost like a POS system online. And brand experience can still be communicated via a website, and that's absolutely fine. But all of these other channels that happen around a brand, a customer is more and more likely to find a product and just want to check out where they are. For example, social media, we see this in developments of Instagram shopping, TikTok shopping, and things like that. Rather than discovering a brand, educating themselves on a website, and this, the website being such a huge part of the ecosystem of the purchase journey, I see it as a much smaller player. I don't know how that's going to play out, but certainly it lends itself to something like Shopify over something like Magento. And I think Magento even now position themselves through Adobe as an experience-driven platform, whereas, you know, I don't know that that is necessarily the long-term answer. But
sure.
Who knows? I'm going to leave it at that because I think we've covered it enough. But what I will say is that if anyone is out there and on Magento, I'm sure either myself or Sean would be willing to send you a life raft and give you some insight. But, you know, you've been quite equally balanced. And I also appreciate that because you did also come at it from a cost perspective. And you actually reframed my thinking on that, where I thought it was going to be significantly cheaper as a total cost of ownership to be on Shopify. And actually, you educated me that through the process you went through, it actually worked out somewhere near the same. So that was quite interesting. Right, lightning round. Best Marvel movie.
I've got to say Winter Soldier, my favorite.
I haven't even seen it. Gonna have to have a look at that.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I'm definitely not going to check out Thor 2, but I am going to check out that one. Golf handicap.
Other than my swing, that's the usual golfer's answer. I'm a little over 7 today.
Not bad. Most embarrassing golfing moment.
So my dad just shared this story. I think I was about 12. We were playing in a father-son tournament and we were leading going to the 18th hole. And it was like a scramble or whatever it was. And might have been a best ball. And we're alternating shots. We were in the bunker. And we're leading by like 2. And I thinned a wedge over the country club clubhouse into the parking lot with half of the membership standing on, like watching from the veranda of the overlooking the 18th hole. Just absolute nightmares, stuff of my nightmares.
Yeah, well, you're probably rightfully disowned in that very moment. Shameful.
Exactly.
You're a bit of a green fingers man, I understand. So what's your favorite flower?
I planted an Asiatic lily that is beautifully red and yellow in kind of a starburst pattern. That's just got to be one of the most beautiful thing I've ever planted in my garden. And I love it.
Good answer. Why are you so obsessed with e-commerce? What keeps you coming back?
I think the ability to take care of customers at scale. I love, I spent the first 15 years of my career in B2B and I love B2C. I love physical product. It's there's so many things going on. Everything we talked about today, it keeps me intellectually curious and humble. And I hate the idea of being bored and doing the same thing every day. And this is anything but.
Mm-hmm. Magento, you had to back it up. Well, if you didn't, you're going to be fighting a losing battle because it will go down on you, but you have to back it up. And usually that's your responsibility through the service. And I can't ask you the question I want to ask you, which is the sponsor question, because you're not yet on Shopify, but I will let you know this. Shopify does not back up your data. So please do install Rewind. Rewind is that established tool that does back up your Shopify store every single day.
It's on our list.
Thank goodness for that. If you need a discount, just let me know and we can hook you up. What vehicles do you currently own? And what is the best vehicle you have ever owned?
Oh, too many vehicles. My wife drives an Audi Q7. I've got a Genesis G80. It's probably the best vehicle I've ever owned, although the Porsche Cayenne we used to own might be up there. The kids all have three the sedans of their own, and I've got a Triumph motorcycle as well. So it's a toss-up between the Porsche and the Triumph, probably. Best vehicle.
Best memory from e-commerce journey so far?
I think 2021 performance for sure. Like we grew so incredibly fast and we're definitely helped along the way through the pandemic spending patterns and the federal government largesse and a few other things. But it's just, what a year. Like it was incredible.
Is that where the cookout started? The team cookout?
No, that's just, we're all back in the office suddenly, at least partially. And we've got a hybrid approach where we're in the office. All leadership is in the office Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and most of the team still comes in Tuesdays. So we've just thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great to kind of, you know, bring in some other folks that aren't even in the office. Our CX team is all fully remote. And so we love the idea of connecting on a more frequent basis than just our quarterly all hands. So That's where that came from.
Bonding over food and fire. You can't beat it. You just can't.
For sure.
And possibly the most important question of the day and the one that everyone will judge you for. Favorite Karen Carpenter song?
Close to you.
Good man.
She was a gem. Yeah.
Awesome. Sean, I appreciate you giving us so much of your time. And how can people reach out to you if they want to?
Yeah, just search me up on the Twitters or on LinkedIn, Sean McGinnis, SeanMcGinnis. I'm kind of hard to miss. I'm the guy with the weird shoe picture. So you find me, connect, say hello. Always happy to kibitz and sort of, talk e-com or D2C or all of the above.
For sure. Sean, thank you so much. Been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Finn. Appreciate it. Good to see you.
The fact that you're still here at the end of this episode tells me that, one, you must have enjoyed it, and two, you're probably as big of an e-commerce geek as I am. Thank you for sticking around, and I just want to give a special thanks to Rewind, Clearco and Vixer for sponsoring this episode. You can find more information and the offers that are associated with those companies in the show notes below. Please also, if you haven't already, go to ecom.gold and subscribe to Gold Club. You'll get alerts about upcoming episodes. You'll get extra content like playbooks from each of the people and guests that we have on the show. And you'll also get access to some of the exclusive content that we have coming up. And finally, do share the show with your friends. Give us a review. It really helps us to build our audience. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Take it easy, and we'll see you next time.